540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
AP News, I'm Ben Thomas. The House has approved a bill protecting same-sex and interracial marriages.
The motion is adopted.
States will now have to recognize same-sex marriages and interracial unions. In one of her final leadership acts before stepping aside, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi presided over the 258-169 vote. Gay lawmakers like Wisconsin's Mark Pocan said he and his husband should have the same rights as any other married couple.
Regardless of if your spouse is named Samuel or Samantha.
40 Republicans voted for the bill, but most were against it, like Virginia's Bob Good.
God's perfect design is indeed marriage between one man and one woman for life.
The vote's a relief for couples worried the Supreme Court might overturn its 2015 decision that legalized those marriages. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Basketball star Brittany Griner is heading home, freed from a Russian prison in exchange for the U.S. release of a Russian arms dealer. Paul Whelan, who's been jailed in Russia for nearly 4 years, was not included, but his brother David says,
"It's a great day to have an American freed from any hostage-taking nation."
The Biden administration is expected to announce a new package of military aid for Ukraine tomorrow, including ammunition and systems to counter drones. The latest poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research finds 43% of respondents approve of President Biden's handling of his job, 55% disapprove. The FBI is seeking cell phone records as it investigates who shot up electric substations in North Carolina. And Rita Foley reports there's been another incident.
Duke Energy says it's working closely with the FBI after reports of gunfire near a power facility in South Carolina. Nobody hurt, says the company. No known property damage and no power failures reported.
This is AP News.
Girls and boys in poverty around the world are dreaming of a better life, filled with dance, art, music, and knowledge. They dream of a brighter future with enough nutritious food to eat, a chance to learn and grow, to get an education, escape poverty, and do incredible things. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, such dreams are coming true. Together, we give children a chance to set their sights high and succeed in school and in life by ensuring that they have access to healthcare, education, life skills, and so much more so they can grow, thrive, and believe in themselves. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today. Together, we can help end poverty for good.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
I'm Pat Kreitlow from Up North News. On an earlier edition, we talked to three women, med students, about whether they're going to stay in Wisconsin to practice medicine.
All this Roe v. Wade stuff, and now OBGYN's hands are so tied. I don't want to go through 12 years of training to have some person that didn't do training tell me how to do my job.
It is not a binary choice. You're for or against abortion. It is a healthcare decision. We all have those stories, and people want to hear them.
Don't miss the real stories here on Up North News.
Mama, what does the chicken say?
Chicken. Oh, okay.
And a wolf?
Oh, a wolf. Ooh!
What about the tiny dog? Cat. Aww. Owl.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Dolphin? What does the turkey say?
Whale sound.
To the giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Okay. Giraffe.
You're not gonna get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff. Like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
For Civic Media, I'm Terry Bell with this news. Judge Jennifer Darrow was defending herself after words she gave a man she convicted for domestic abuse last week 2 days to report to jail. In that time, sheriff's deputies in Illinois say Michael Liu broke into his in-laws' home and shot at them and stabbed them several times. Darrow's Wisconsin Supreme Court campaign says most judges actually give abuse convicts more time to report to jail. Wisconsin taxpayers will likely have to pay state taxes on any student loan debt forgiven. Some tax professionals are telling people to report loan forgiveness as income, even if they don't get a 1099-C form from their loan servicer. In sports, the Bucks beat Sacramento last night. College volleyball Sweet 16 play today. Wisconsin host Penn State and Marquette takes on top-seeded Texas. You're listening to The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
And we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Thank goodness Tuesday is over. I'm sure the good folks in Georgia are as happy as all of us. And that a sane, rational senator will be seated in the Senate from Georgia. And I got to tell you, I'm just shocked and amazed at where we are. Today, very special program. I've made it over to Birmingham, Alabama from Atlanta. One of my favorite places for ribs. Yes, one of my favorite food places on the planet. And I'm sitting here with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones, who's been gracious enough to bring us in and share some thoughts on the election on Tuesday. Doug, thanks for taking time for us.
Look, I'm so glad you came over, Rick. I always appreciate you making time. And it's always great to share a plate of barbecue with anybody from out of town that appreciates good barbecue.
No, it was fabulous today. And thank you for that. But you know, here, let's talk about what happened Tuesday, because I'm still shocked and amazed that Herschel Walker came anywhere close. I had said I thought it was going to be a 3-5% race if folks were allowed to vote, 5-7%. It was 3%, but it should not have been that close.
No, there's no question. It should not have been that close. But it was the same way it played out over over all of the contested races across the country, where there were kind of swing state districts, swing state states. The tribalism in this country is so strong that it is going to make these races continue to be close. Continue to be competitive, which is a good news, bad news thing. The good news is you want to love competitive races where people are competing. The bad news is that it is so tribal now, where people are putting on the jerseys, their red jersey or blue jersey, that races like this, when you have as flawed a candidate as you had in Herschel Walker, can maintain and actually get this close when it should never have been close. Everybody, I think, fully appreciates the fact that Georgia deserved better than a Herschel Walker. Warnock said it over and over, and I think the people of Georgia ultimately got it. But it was damn close, because right now people are conditioned to vote for their team and not for the person, or what the person stands for, because no one could know what Herschel Walker stood for.
And that's the thing. As we were on the ground talking to people, no one had any idea of what he was talking about. All they said was, and I'll never forget this, and this was multiple times, that he's an imperfect vessel, and that he's a good one. He's a good one. He will do what he's told. And there's a lot to unpack in that. But the first time I heard it, I go, well, that's odd. But I heard it several times over my course of the 10 days I was there in Atlanta. And that's scary.
And they say that there is no racism in America anymore. He's a good one. Oh, come on. He'll do what he's told? I mean, we're...
Isn't that what the messaging was? Because they had him between Lindsey Graham and...
And that has been part of the, you know, the whole thing with the Southern strategy is to divide people, to do things. And Herschel Walker was acceptable as a good one because he got anointed. But he was going to do as he was told. I mean, think about that. That's coming from the Deep South. That is just horrific in this day and age, but it is absolutely true. And you go into other places, and it doesn't have to be the race thing. You would have seen that with Dr. Oz. You would have seen it with others that will do what they're told. They don't want free thinkers sometime. And especially in red states in the South, people have grown up and have been conditioned to vote a certain way. And it takes a lot to get them to move off of it. Fortunately, in Georgia, there were just enough people to move off of that and just enough independents that recognized the differences in these candidates that truly was able to put the victory in Warnock's column.
Yeah, no, I've been saying for a long time, you know, we've been hit with this red hat, blue hat thing, and I keep coming back to, it's not about the red hats or the blue hats, it's got to be about the hard hats.
Absolutely.
And moving us forward and rebuilding this country and to do the things that the working class of this country needs, because as long as we stay red hat, blue hat, we're never going to get the things that we need, education, healthcare, infrastructure, jobs, any of those things. We're going to continue just to fight amongst each other for the crumbs that are left.
There's no question about it, and we've gotten to the point in this country that so many people are seeing their teams not in a competition with the other, but it's literally good versus evil. It is one of those things where people are stoking violence. People, you look at what happened January 6th, people legitimately thought, and I say legitimately, they believed, whether, you know, you can't really say legitimately believed because the whole premise was not legitimate. But the fact is, so many people believe the election was stolen, and they would resort to violence to that. Right now, there are people across this country who truly believe that every Democrat is evil, regardless of which side of the tent, the big tent that Democrats are, they think that you're evil. Likewise, there are folks in the Democratic Party that think everybody, not just these MAGA extremist, clearly Oathkeeper type racist folks are evil, but that the average Republican voter is evil. And we got to get away from that. We got to start building a middle here. We got to start building the center a little bit stronger so that we can compete for those voices, so we can compete for ideas, because that's how you get this country moving forward.
No, you're absolutely right. Because look, I remember a period where I had Republican friends who were staunch conservatives, and we would have conversations, we would argue, we would go back and forth. And at the end of the day, we'd walk away from each other, not wanting harm or ill to fall upon the other. And yet all of those friends that I've had have fallen off by the wayside because now we have to be enemies. And this is, it's not healthy for democracy to have this be the scenario we're in. I want to fight over ideas. I want to argue about the best way to make lives better and to help people without having to demonize.
No, and because here's the problem. You're not supposed to make a bargain with the devil. If you think the other side is the devil and a demon, you're not going to want to try to have a dialogue with them and find a common ground. You're going to assume that there is no common ground. And that's where I think the problem on both the right and the left are right now. If you assume that the other side is in a place to where you cannot find common ground because they're demons, they're evil, then you're not even going to look for it. And I think we've got to move back from that. Yeah. You know, think about the foreign policy. I was tweeted something yesterday about the fact that Biden, the number of ambassadors for Biden that are vacant right now because he can't get them through the Senate is extraordinary. In a time when, you know, tensions across the globe are rising. And it's not just the Middle East anymore. It's in Europe with Russia. It's with China. And our foreign policy, it used to be said that partisanship stopped at the water's edge.
Right.
No longer. You've got Republicans holding these nominees up. You've got them trying to inject their own views. And it's just sometimes just one or two senators. we've got to figure this out. I mean, we've got to figure out a way that we can find that common ground without demonizing the other.
Well, what do you say to my Republican friends who would go, but, you know, the Democrats did this first. When you guys were in the Senate, you blocked Trump's nominees.
No, that's not true. You know, the fact of the matter is, when I was in the Senate, Mitch McConnell controlled the floor. And the fact is, we put through, and Donald Trump put through, what, a third of the judiciary right now, or 25%, something like that. There were a ton of those nominees that went through there. But the one thing that you're talking about, and I want to make a clear distinction, by the way, between a lifetime appointment in the judiciary with an ambassador that's going to come and go with this administration. I think there's a huge difference with that. I've always believed that a president, even a Donald Trump in the day, should have his team in place.
Right.
And give the president, he was elected by the people of this country, and put that team in place. So the needle kind of moves toward a presumption of doing that. There is a difference when you're talking about a lifetime appointment that is going to be there long after that president leaves. So you did not see as many of the nominees blocked. You know, there is no filibuster, by the way, Rick, in the Senate for nominees for either judiciary or the administration. But senators can still make blocks. And were there some blocked? Absolutely. There's always those games that are played. But by and large, I think nominations move through the Senate when I was there in the 3 years that I was there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, reflexively, what people do is they're going to, well, you did it first. And this is the kind of stuff that has to at some point stop, because we're coming towards a Republican-led House very soon. And,
yes.
And I think everyone is anticipating whoever the speaker is going to be. It doesn't look like McCarthy's going to have the votes. Maybe he will. But it looks like the crazy wing, they're going to want an impeachment for who knows what reason. I'm sure they'll find something. But they want their pound of flesh back, it seems.
Yeah, there's no question. And there's got to be in the Senate and the House enough political courage to say no. Yes. The other side did X, whatever that X might be. But we need to be better than that. We need to get back. And I think if that can start, it would snowball. It would carry over. But there was that. And look, I'm going to be honest. In the Democratic caucus when I was there, I heard it a lot, especially in that last year. We don't want to do X. We don't want to give Donald Trump a win. Well, that's, you know, I never agreed with it. I spoke up against it because I said, look, this is not about Donald Trump. This is a piece of legislation that ought to pass. We ought to be able to work with and claim credit for it yourself a little bit, but it's going to be good for America. But there are those folks on both sides of the aisle that, you know, the filibuster is a good example. You know, the minute Mitch McConnell takes the gavel again, he's going to get rid of the filibuster. So we may as well do it now to push through our
agenda. You're in favor of eliminating the filibuster?
No, I'm not. I have never been in favor of completely eliminating. I do think there are serious rule changes that need to be made in the U.S. Senate to get the filibuster back into an area when it was where it was supposed to be, and you just can't phone in an objection. And you've got to hold the floor. You've got to do these things and give people time to work through some things. I think there is a space for the filibuster because the Senate was designed to give the minority a voice, but it was never designed to let the minority completely block legislation that a majority of the United States Senate and a majority of the public are pushing through. But there does need to be some changes. And when those changes, if they ever come, you know, they're going to bite Democrats on occasion. Yeah. There will be a time when there is a Republican Senate and a Republican House and a Republican president. And it will bite the Democrats. But that's the way America works. That's the way democracy works. It's not always pretty.
Yeah.
But it
no, we're seeing that.
It's still the greatest system that's been devised yet. And if we can just, as Ben Franklin said, we've got a republic if we can just hold on to it.
Yeah, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Doug Jones, former Alabama senator. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com here in Birmingham, Alabama. You know, you bring up the idea of the filibuster, and I've said from the beginning, I want to go back to the, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington days where you've got to hold the floor. A talking filibuster is what, if it's so important important that something stops, everything should stop, in my view.
Absolutely.
But, you know, nobody really wants to do that. I mean, we're not that kind of a society, I don't think. Do you see us moving back to that potentially?
You know, I don't know. Here's an interesting...
Because my fear is, and I agree with you, my fear is that you do away with it entirely, and now we end up having these wild pendulum swings.
Absolutely.
And we become a banana republic of, once Social Security is destroyed, you don't immediately rebuild it.
Right.
Once you make these really big draconian kind of cuts to social programs, it's hard to rebuild that. So I do have some fear. While I do advocate for doing away with it, I do have some fear.
No, there's no question. And here's an interesting thing that people don't fully appreciate about the Senate rules right now. You go back to Mr. Smith goes to Washington and holding that floor, just that alone. Any senator right now can hold that floor for as long as they want to. You're normally given X amount of time. But if you want to sit there and read green eggs and ham and hold that floor forever, you can. But you got to hold the floor. And you can still do that. You can still quote
I've watched all of Bernie's.
Yeah. You can hold it. But at the moment you take a break, you relinquish that floor, and that's when things move. There's got to be a procedure in place where people can't just phone in an objection. You got to make relevant arguments on the debate, and you have a series of votes. And it gives people time, Rick. A filibuster is designed to give people time. That if you could literally shut down the Senate during this filibuster, okay, during the debate, and there's no other votes that can be taken on the floor. You can't do unanimous consent votes. You can't do anything. It shuts down the Senate. At some point, both sides are going to say, we got to figure out how to do this. We either got to come to an agreement or somebody has got to abandon this. And when those filibusters happened, and the rare occasion in the 60s, 70s, when the filibusters took place, you would have senators caucusing in the majority or minority leader's office or in the cloakrooms trying to figure out the way. How can we break this? People often forget that the filibuster was rarely used until more modern history. And by that, I mean in the last 20 or 30 years. It was just rarely used because folks could get together. We really need to get back. That's the deliberative body that the United States Senate should be. Not just where folks that the only thing you see on C-SPAN is political speeches on the floor. They can give their damn speeches anywhere they want to. But on the Senate floor, it needs to be substantive speeches about the issue at hand that they are voting on.
No, the reason I want to go back to a talking filibuster is just what you said. I want you to tell me why you're against X, Y, or Z. Why can't we provide sick days to all workers? Why can't we help, you know, single mothers who need food and health care and things for children? Tell me why. Just don't read the phone book. I think you should have to stay on task. But you brought up C-SPAN, and I've often questioned whether that was the beginning of the downfall of that working together, because now the average citizen sees the sausage making. They see these senators who have now become media stars. I look in the House, we've got a number of people. I don't believe they're working on any substantive legislation to help me or anybody else, but they are working on their rising media star.
Yeah, you're not seeing the sausage being made on C-SPAN unless you start listening to committee hearings and going behind the scenes and listening to the staff talking, which you'll never get. You don't see it by watching the House floor or the Senate floor. You see political speeches. It may be about the issue that they're debating, but the odds are it is not going to be. They're going to be bashing the other side. It's going to be a purely political speech, or as you said, it's going to be a self-aggrandizing speech to up their political game. I think it would be easy to say to put the blame on television in the House and the Senate, but I think it's really more per people. Yeah. I think it really should come down to people having the political will and the political courage to not just make those speeches, but have the kind of colloquy that you're talking about. You're not talking about just asking the questions or making the speech. What you're talking about is a back and forth between senators. You know, tell me why you don't like paid family leave, and let them answer on the floor of the Senate. And then ask more questions. I mean, it's that kind of give and take that you miss so much In the U.S. Senate these days.
Yeah, I mean, it just looks like everything has become political grandstanding just to raise money and to get votes and more raising money.
Yeah.
You know, so this is where I look at this and I go, you know, Citizens United did, I believe, irreparable harm. And now money is speech and wealthy people have much more speech than an average everyday working stiff like me or you. And you know, something has to be done on this frame because the money is getting out of hand.
Oh, my God. The money that was spent this election cycle, the money that's going to be spent the next election cycle is stunning. And it is not, by the way, the money that the money that the candidates are raising. Remember, a candidate, Herschel Walker, a Raphael Warnock, name the candidate themselves. They can only raise this like $2,900 an election per person, okay? That's all.
Right.
PACs can give $5,000 per election, which means like in Georgia, they could have given $5,000 to Warnock and Walker during the primary, another $5,000 for the general election, and another $5,000 for the runoff. So these PACs and all of this corporate money that go to candidates, you know, it's pretty limited. They don't have that control. It's the independent expenditures. It's the super PACs. It's the C4 organizations, which don't even have to report their donors. That's where this money is coming in. That's where all the money was spent. Democrats this year, as candidates, outraised their Republican counterparts across the country by whopping amounts. But it was the individual PACs and C4s and independent expenditures where the big money, the $10, $12, $15, $20 million donors are putting in money. And you can rattle off all the names. We don't have to. You can rattle off all the names. That's where the money is. It's the independent expenditures. If we could somehow limit that and keep it within the campaigns and let the campaigns only run the show, wow, what a difference it would make.
Yeah, because if you look at these TV ads, I mean... Oh my gosh, who's got the money? Comcast has got to be thrilled because they're making tons of money. But I don't even know that half of the ads are anywhere near accurate.
No. Well, they don't have to be accurate anymore. There's no reason for them to have to be accurate. They're not going to be challenged. And what you see, if people think about these ads, you know, under a campaign, if you're an ad that is running on behalf of a campaign, like my TV ads that I ran, at the end of every one of them, I had to say, I'm Doug Jones and I approve this message for the very reason that you're talking about, that to give some honesty that the candidate knows what the hell is being said in that TV ad. These super PAC ads, these C4 ads, you don't hear that. You don't see that. And that's where most of the money was spent.
Yeah.
It's in those ads where you don't know who the hell the donors are. And that's a problem, too. The secretive dark money in this country is stunning. And I think people, if they really drill down on it, I think they would be appalled and I think they would do something about it. Unfortunately, most people are really busy dealing with their lives than to have to rise up on campaign finance.
And do you have hope? I mean, going forward, I mean, the way things are, it looks like we're rocketing in different directions.
No.
And you know, there's a moment where I've had people just, I just want it to stop.
Yeah.
You know, and I go back to 2011 in Wisconsin, 11 and 12, and, you know, the voters there were just, please let it stop. The folks here in Georgia, this is the second, you know, Senate race that's had a runoff, and all of the attention and the phone calls and the door knocking and all the stuff that groups are doing to get out the vote. People are just like, can we just stop?
Right.
You know, and it's turning, I fear that it's turning people away.
Well, it may be. I don't know. There is something to be said, though, Rick, the fact that we have seen a rise in the number of people voting.
Yeah.
I mean, look at this. I mean, look what happened. That was a rise. So, you know, where I have hope is that I saw in this election cycle a rise in the younger voters of this country getting out to vote. That's what gives me hope.
I'm right there with you. Can you stick around to the break?
Absolutely.
We're going to take a quick break right here. On the other side, we're going to come back and talk with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. I want to get some of his thoughts here locally about some of my conversations here in Birmingham. Going to take a quick break. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com. Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you...
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Muskego to Pewaukee, always streaming at WAUKradio.com.
Capitol Riot. I'm Ben Thomas with an AP News Minute. Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn testified before a special grand jury in Atlanta Thursday. It's investigating whether then-President Trump and others illegally tried to influence the 2020 election in Georgia. Meantime, Trump's recent online post repeating lies about the election being stolen and calling for termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution, has made the list of this year's most notable quotes. His words drew this reaction from his former Vice President Mike Pence.
In these divided times, it's important for leaders in both political parties to make it clear, whatever our differences, that we support the Constitution of the United States.
Trump's remark was number two on the list compiled by Yale Law School librarian Fred Shapiro. Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky had the number one quote, "I need ammunition, not a ride," turning down a U.S. offer to transport him to safety days after Russia invaded Ukraine. I'm Ben Thomas.
Girls and boys in poverty around the world are dreaming of a better life, filled with dance, art, music, and knowledge. They dream of a brighter future with enough nutritious food to eat, a chance to learn and grow, to get an education, escape poverty, and do incredible things. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, such dreams are coming true. Together, we give children a chance to set their sights high and succeed in school and in life by ensuring that they have access to healthcare, education, life skills, and so much more so they can grow, thrive, and believe in themselves. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today. Together, we can help end poverty for good.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
So all you folks out there, if you haven't registered to vote, register to vote. Get ready to vote. There are so many things on the ballot this November, at our freedom, our liberty, and our way of life. But we'll get to all of that this evening.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m. on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnier with your headlines. It's been a good year for Wisconsin, the state dipping below 3% unemployment in the last 12 months, the current rate 3.3%, but a worker shortage still projected in the coming years. Amy Pekacek, secretary designee for the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, tells the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel there are roughly two job openings for every job seeker in the state, so Wisconsin trying to re-engage people who've been out of the workforce for a number of reasons, including incarceration. There are currently 10 job centers and correctional facilities helping inmates get employment once they're released. Richland Center community members frustrated with the proposed closing of the UW Richland campus. Supporters say some of the reasons for declining enrollment are due to the UW system's lack of financial support, drastic reductions in faculty and staff, and no marketing or strategic plans. They'll forward a petition to Governor Evers, UW System President Jay Rothman, and area lawmakers. You're listening to The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
This is Jim Hightower saying,
If billionaire humanoids like Elon really wanted to save us from extinction, they would do the honorable thing by going first.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So today I stopped in Birmingham, downtown Birmingham, went over by the Civil Rights Center that was, I've talked about many times here. I was in Kelly Ingram Park and took the tour, grabbed a couple of local tour guides. Generally when someone walks up to me and asks for a dollar, I say, I'll give you a dollar, but you give me the tour, I'll give you 20. Well, both gentlemen gave me the tour and very, very good information. But both of them, when they asked, hey, why are you here? I said, well, I'm here to interview former Senator Doug Jones. And they all looked at me with big eyes, big smiles, and said, he's a bad man. And here to share some thoughts on being
bad,
that.
But bad in a good way, right?
No, he was. No, they were effusive with praise, Doug, because, you know, again, the look in their eyes, the look on their faces, they knew you're a champion. And then they went into the whole fact that you're the guy who went and prosecuted the people who are responsible for killing those four little girls in the 16th Street Baptist Church bomb.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of folks. I still get far too much credit for all of that. We were successful, and I'm very, very proud of it. So I'm glad some people that are roaming through the park still recognize it.
No, but, you know, the reality is, and this is where, you know, in my mind, I listened to the stories of these two gentlemen who were, you know, young children at the time, talking about their experience, you know, growing up in this environment. And I couldn't help but think about the bravery of those kids who came out of that church for the Children's March. And look, I can't imagine the bravery, you know, of you and your staff and the people who actually finally sought justice in this, something that could have been easily let go.
Well, it could have been let go, Rick, but at the same time, I think for those of us who even looked at that case, you just couldn't let it go. I mean, there was something deep down that you just could not let go. You knew that justice had not been served. It had been served only partially with a 1977 conviction. And none of us that worked on that case, and we did it for, you know, I became U.S. attorney in 97. I left right after the first of those bombings in 01, so it took 3 or 4 years. None of us ever considered what we were doing to be brave. We really believed in what we were doing. We felt and knew that it was the right thing to do. We also knew that, you know, that in a time and a place earlier in Birmingham's history, that the investigation was actually thoroughly investigated by the FBI. It's kind of a legend that it was not, that Hoover didn't really want to solve it. Not true. He actually did want to solve it because he felt that the Bureau's reputation was at stake.
Right.
Okay. So he put a lot of resources, but there was the myth that he never did. And so part of this was also to make sure that the people of this city, the people in that community felt like that somebody had come in there and looked and cared enough to reopen it, take the chances on it. And we were very fortunate. We were fortunate with our evidence. We were fortunate enough with people that had lived long enough to testify. And we were fortunate enough that a jury in Alabama finally would give the prosecution and the defense a fair shake. And that's all you're supposed to ask for in a court of law.
Yeah, and, you know, the first time we came down here was 2015. We did a civil rights tour because, you know how those things go. Your kids come home from school. What'd you learn today? Kind of thing. And my oldest daughter came home and said, you know, she learned about Rosa Parks. And I quizzed her. You know, what did you learn? And it was just, she was tired. And I go, well, there's a lot more to that. So, you know, me doing this and wanting my kids to learn a little bit more, we decided, hey, let's go to these places and let's talk to people and learn the actual history. And the reason I bring this up is, you know, we're battling over this theory about race that's critical and this argument right. that we're seeing in school boards and all this. I want people to know what really happened so that it never happens again.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, to me, that's the reason you learn history.
Well, there's no question about that. And I just finished reading John Meacham's new book about Lincoln. That's remarkable. And the way he documented everything that he put in there about the South and about slavery and about how the South still, after the end of the war, wanted to promulgate this myth of the lost cause, which we are still dealing with today. We are absolutely still dealing with here today. But it is exactly the reason we have to learn this history accurately, factually. You cannot put a gloss over some of the things that we've done in this country. But the fact is, you learn from those things. It's like human thing. You have learned from your mistakes in life. At least I hope you have. I know I have learned from most of them anyway. We still, I get it. But the fact is, that's how you do learn and grow.
The big ones anyway.
The big ones, absolutely. There's no question. And so, that's why I just get so dismayed listening to these people talking about that we really need to kind of gloss over this whole slavery issue and as if there is not still vestiges of that systemic racism that exists today. It does. And we need to face that. And when we can face it and talk about it, we can deal with it. But if you don't face it and you don't want to talk about it, you don't want to learn about it, it's hard to deal with.
Yeah. Now, I had always said, growing up in Cleveland is a very segregated city. I grew up in a minority community. I was the white kid in the black neighborhood.
Right.
We played this neat game called Jace the White Kid and Beat Him Up, which wasn't a fun game. But early on, I learned that the only color that really mattered was green, because at the end of the month, growing up in the projects, we were all broke. So for a long time, I thought that was the frame of mind. It wasn't really until that tour that I did in 2015, because I thought I had a handle on it, where you went into a lot of these places where we treated black people really, really badly. And now there's a tourist trap there to bring people in. I hope it's to educate, but there's a lot of tourism around how bad we were to people. And there's so many opportunities to educate. But even then, for me, it wasn't until you see these images and you see the history and you... I'll give you one moment. It was at the Civil Rights Center here. And there's a little case with the four girls' belongings.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an emotional person. I get choked up about nothing. I don't cry at movies. But a tear came to my eye looking into that box where there was a little clutch purse of one of the little girls. Who had, things that my kids who were that age would have in their purses. And it was that moment that it became, right? It became real.
It became personal. I mean, we had, and I tell this story a lot, there were two things in the bombing trials that we did that really brought home, I think, the horror of those murders. One was Denise McNair's shoes that we introduced into evidence.
Yeah.
The other, Rick, was a piece of mortar that was embedded in Denise McNair's skull as a result of that bombing that her father had gotten from the mortician, and he kept it and he displayed it at his photography studio, Chris McNair. And I asked him one time, because we had been friends for a long time, I said, "Why do you display this, Chris? It seems a little bit over the top." And he said, "Doug, people mourn. They come and they mourn for the kids, and they're sad about what happened. But until they see the mortar that was embedded in Denise's skull, they really can't appreciate what people can do in the name of hate."
Yeah.
And so I wanted that jury to not only see that piece of mortar, but to feel it. And the shoes, because it brings it all home. I'll never forget in the closing argument of the first trial, the defense lawyer accused me of injecting sympathy into the trials. And my retort was, "I didn't murder those kids. This guy murdered those kids. If there is any sympathy being injected for the families, it's because of the actions of this man right here."
Yeah.
I think when people come to Birmingham, people go to Montgomery for the, the Equal Justice Initiative lynching memorial. That's an incredibly powerful and moving, and you cannot help from walk away from there with a different feeling about this country, about where it is. But it's not a bad feeling. And that's what I want people to realize, that when you learn about this, you're like, how could some of this happen? But you don't come away with it ashamed. You come away with it with a resolve to make sure we continue to do better, to make this more perfect union. That's what this is all about.
Yeah, I mean, when we were here in 2015, we did a number of interviews with people who were the children who were in the march. And,
right.
I think about the bravery that must have taken, 50 at a time to be leaving that church, to walk out to the dogs, the tanks, the water cannons, all of that. But there was one guy who stuck out in my mind, and his name was Fate Morris. And the story that he told, I had no idea who he was.
Right.
And we're sitting out, we're talking, and all of a sudden he's telling me this story. And this old broken down man just starts sobbing as if the memory of finding his sister was yesterday.
Right, absolutely. Cynthia Morris Wesley, who has been living with the Wesley family at the time of her death. Fate was just, again, the families of these victims were just absolutely incredible to deal with. They really were. They were, but it was all still very real. It's as, again, as I, and I go back to some of the things I was saying in the trial, that a mother's heart never stops weeping for the loss of a child. And we had two mamas that testified in those trials in 2001 and 2002. And it was an emotional time.
So, you know, the reason I bring this up is because we're in a moment in this country where we're arguing about history. We're arguing about that happening. We're arguing about, you know, did other parts of history happen, and in the worst ways. I mean, we've got Holocaust deniers. We've got right-wing extremists. And again, this divergence away from the middle of the road and common ground seems to be accelerating. And I'm not sure how we stop that.
Yeah, no, look, it is not just about race anymore. It's race, it's religion. It's not just about black and white anymore. You just have seen in the last few years, you saw what happened in Charleston, South Carolina. You saw what happened in Charlottesville. You saw what happened in Buffalo, New York. You see what happened in Uvalde, Texas. You see where things go and people are going crazy. And there is this sense that the political rhetoric is stoking some of this violence, because it's really hard for people to understand that when you start talking a certain way, there are people out there that have triggers, and those triggers, it doesn't take much to set them off, and it leads to violence. People have to be a lot more careful
right.
with what they're saying and what they're doing, because today's political world is much more than just black and white. It is much, much more than that. It includes the gay community, it includes religion and the Muslim community, it includes Hispanics, it includes the Chinese. Think about all of the hate crimes that the Chinese have endured based on a lot of Donald Trump's rhetoric. And of course, you've still got the rise of the anti-Semitic violence that has been occurring in this country the last 4 or 5 years. We got to figure this out. We got to figure this out without tearing each other apart.
So is this a political problem? You know, because I thought I kind of had a handle on the rise of Trumpism. You know, I talk about my family, who basically are the basket of deplorables. They've always been somewhat racist, somewhat homophobic, somewhat misogynistic. It's the era in which they grew up. And I'm not justifying it.
Sure.
But that never motivated them to vote before. What motivated them to vote was Trump told them, conned them into believing that he was going to recreate Brook Park Avenue. He was going to bring back all those union jobs, all that manufacturing, all the things that gave them hope and opportunity for the present and the future. You know, the wages, the hours, the conditions, the healthcare, all that stuff. They thought that was coming back. It wasn't the race. It wasn't right. the misogyny. But we seem to be picking up on the other side of it. You know, while desperation, and I've heard it said a number of times that give me somebody who's a little bit desperate, a little bit afraid, a little bit fearful. You give me enough time, and I'll give you a jihadist or a Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that where we are?
Yeah, no. Look, and again, there's a lot to unpack, as you said earlier. I agree. I completely understand. I saw the same thing here in Alabama and other places where people thought that Donald Trump was going to bring back all. He was going to make America great again, despite the fact that I don't know what the hell that meant. Did they think it was going to be okay to make it the way it was in the 50s with segregated lunch counters? I don't know. But they really believed it was going to happen. And when it did not happen, and it did not happen under Donald Trump for those folks, it only happened for Wall Streeters and the most in corporate America and the richest in America. It did not help the folks in Alabama. It did not help your family probably. And they blamed somebody else.
Right.
And it was easy to blame Democrats and socialists, which were just completely the opposite. I mean, it was just farcical. But there was they didn't want to blame Donald Trump for not delivering. They blamed Democrats and others for stopping him from succeeding, which was just unbelievable to me that people would still buy into his just total BS.
Yeah.
But they are.
They believe that there was a plan. There was a master plan.
There was a plan. There was a plan. And if we were just successful, he would follow through with it. With Donald Trump's master plan has always been about Donald Trump.
No, excellent point. But you know, we're in this moment, and again, and I keep coming back to where we are, where we seem to be normalizing the kind of hatred and the kind of things that. I remember learning about the Holocaust, and I remember learning about that era and going, how could they be so stupid? How could they fall for that kind of rhetoric? But I fear here we are.
Oh, yeah. No, look, it was just the basic not standing up and speaking out. That's the fear that I have. That's why I've been critical of Republican leaders who have been so reluctant to challenge not racism, because they all challenge racism and say that there's no place. They all challenge bigotry and say there's no place in America for that or in the Republican Party. They all challenge violence. No, they challenge it, but then they are silent when they're talking about the individuals who are stoking that. They need to be saying there is no longer any place for in American politics for Donald Trump. Not with what he is doing when he is having candlelight dinners with avowed racist and anti-Semites, when he is talking about literally tearing up the Constitution of the United States simply because he didn't win an election. There is some serious, serious stuff going on there that needs to be repudiated more than just simply some generic, a person that says that will never get elected. Well, they're going to get elected unless you, Mitch McConnell, unless you Republican leaders stand up and speak out against not what's being said, against the individual that's saying it, and take the chance. We've got to have, you go back, Rick, to what we do. We are in this moment. I agree with you. But it does need to take a little political courage on both sides of the aisle to stand up and speak out and to push back hard when we see things like that, to push back, not just on the rhetoric, but push back on the individuals given the rhetoric and let the political chips fall where they're going to fall. Yeah. And right now there's too many people that are too worried about protecting their political backsides than they are about protecting the country.
Does it start with having to hold Donald Trump accountable? I mean, I know a lot of people are talking about the January 6th committee. Now they've said they're going to make criminal referrals. I look at the story today. Evidently, there's a storage locker somewhere that's got more documents in it. I wonder what Trump left in the White House. And I got to wonder what more is. He had classified documents. Is it this sense that nobody's accountable anymore? I mean, because if it were me, they'd be locking me up by now.
Oh yeah, there's no question. But now look, in DOJ's defense and some other things, this is a unique situation where you've got to make sure you get it right. You cannot just barrel into this thing because you know you're going to be accused of politics. So I do think that there is some accountability that has to be had. What form that takes, though, I think remains to be seen. And I'm going to let Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice do their job. I've got a lot of confidence in them, and I've got a lot of confidence in the way this is being handled right now.
So you, as a former prosecutor, I want to make sure I get this straight, because a lot of us, me included, are going, come on, let's move this along.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I get it. Look, I totally get it. But here's the reason that you're feeling that. You're feeling that because a separate branch of government, the legislative branch, had hearings, conducted their own investigation, a lot of public evidence out that cannot be used in a trial in a court of law.
Right.
Completely different track. And so they took depositions. DOJ can't take depositions. They've only got to bring them in front of a grand jury unless they just want to give them a statement. There is so different, Rick, that the great thing about the January 6th committee is that they have been incredibly deliberate. They've been incredibly efficient. They have moved with much more speed than I thought they could do with an incredible amount of evidence that they had to work with. But that the downside is it creates in the public's mind, why hasn't DOJ gone ahead? If the January 6th committee could do this, why can't DOJ? And it is a completely different branch of government with completely different sets of rules. And you've got to make sure you get it right. Because at the end of the day, you're not playing for public opinion. You're not playing for history. You've got to convince 12 men and women on a jury unanimously that someone is guilty of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a pretty heavy burden. So the burden on the DOJ is just unbelievable right now.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. You know, Doug, I'm looking at this, and again, I want to kind of wrap this around the idea that, you know, maybe there's a way forward. You know, again, we're in these polar opposite sides. We've got our teams. How do we move this forward? I mean, you know, it's going to be in 2 years of insanity in the House. I fear. I just see us getting worse and worse. Where do you see things? How would you move things forward?
I think you move things forward by continuing to try to have the dialogues. You continue to try to reach out across and find common ground. You cannot govern with my way or the highway. That's the success that the last 2 years have been is because there have been compromises in legislation that has done great things that have not been done before. You've got to continue on that path. If the House wants to spend all their time looking into somebody's laptop, fine. But you need to push back on that with facts. You can't let the distortion of those facts overshadow the good things that is going on with the administration, the good things that are going to be going on with the Senate. But at the same time, there's just got to be people on both sides of the aisle that will sit down in a common purpose. And Rick, there are a lot more that goes on than people see. That's the thing we were talking about C-SPAN and everything else, that they only see the vitriol, they only see the political speeches. They don't see what's going on between the senators and their staffs behind the scenes trying to find that common ground. They just need to talk about it more, and we need to dial back the rhetoric a little bit more about where we are in this country. That will help, because if folks in Washington, D.C. will do that, it will filter down to the public, because it's the public is a reflection of what they see going on, not what's actually going on up there. That's the crazy thing about this. So you
actually saw this kind of walking.
Absolutely.
Because we're led to believe that, you know, you watch the F channel, you watch some of the media, you know, everyone's, you know, yelling at each other. It doesn't look like there's any.
Oh, no, there are things there. I had bipartisan bills, 20-something bipartisan bills that signed into law in only 3 years. And it was because I could sit down and my staff could sit down with Tom Cotton, who I disagree with on so many issues, but we found some common ground on some issues in the banking committee. Ted Cruz and I found something on the Cold Civil Rights Case Act. We were able to do that in different ways. So there is a lot of that going on. The rules of the Senate somehow prohibit that. And the thing that I criticize a little bit is that senators often will sign up on bills and it'll be a bipartisan bill, and they think they've done their job to be bipartisan. But that's really only part of the story. They need to publicly get there with those folks and together tout them. We saw that happen in the infrastructure bill, unfortunately, and we saw it happen with the CHIPS Act. We saw it happen with the PAC Act for veterans. We need to see it more. Yeah. We'll see it with the NDAA to some extent, the National Defense Authorization. We'll see it with some appropriations if they can ever get there. But they need to have more pieces of legislation that they can sit there and not just work behind the scenes and let it quietly pass, but actually stand shoulder to shoulder and talk about the work that they've done together to find common ground.
Yeah, one of those areas I thought would have been a good place would, I don't know, paid sick days. Because I do want to get your thoughts on how the administration did handle the rail situation. Because I've been pretty vocally in opposition of what President Biden has done. And I'm a supporter. I think it could have been handled differently. But this could be one of those things like you're talking about.
Yeah, no, look, I think when you look back, a lot of things can always be handled differently as you look in the rearview mirror as opposed to looking forward. And the fact of the matter is, I think that the administration was faced with a very difficult situation. They helped try to negotiate something that they felt like could pass. It did not pass. We're getting into a point, the economy is just beginning to recover. The supply chains, the economics are there. People are working. The economy with a rail strike would have been disastrous. And I think they were between a rock and a hard place.
No, everyone agrees on that. And I completely agree with that.
But I think the messaging could have been better. For sure, I'm always one that thinks messaging could have been better. Even my own messaging that I did in the campaigns, I think, could have been better. But the fact is, we had to do something. And also, I think that going forward, there's still going to be some opportunities. It is a shame that we didn't have more paid leave in that agreement. It is a shame that people are having to either make more money, but yet they can't really appreciate or spend it the way they need to because they don't have the time off. Some of the things that happened over the last few years, I think, were just something that the American people didn't fully appreciate and didn't understand. And I think that folks could have done a better job of maybe driving that home, because people want folks to be safe, healthy, happy, and you can only do that when you've got the ability to spend some time with your family.
Now, I hope someone's listening, and I hope we do start moving in the right direction. But Doug, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Really good stuff.
Hey, thank you, Rick. Anytime. It's always great to be with you.
Our good friend, former Alabama Senator Doug Jones. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick, @thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Make sure you grab the podcast.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.